Welcome to Talking About Forests, a podcast series hosted jointly by Dalberg Advisors and Wildlife Conservation Trust. Join hosts Dr. Anish Andheria, President of the Wildlife Conservation Trust, and Neerad Bhatnagar, partner at Dalberg, as they engage in stimulating conversations with researchers, conservationists, bureaucrats, and philanthropists on extremely pressing topics, including governance, forest management, ecosystem services, wildlife crime, and human-wildlife conflict.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode on forest governance. Our interactions with forests impact us in many ways. They impact our food and water security, human and environmental health, biodiversity, and also economic development. And hence, it is important to have good structures and regulations to ensure sustainable, efficient, and equitable governance of forests, among other types of ecosystems. Today, we have with us two very eminent people in Kanchi Kohli and Prakash Kaswan. They will together help us understand what forest governance really means, what are the challenges that the sector is facing, what are the best practices and what can be done to improve forest governance. So with this, I would like to now invite Neerad to do the honors.
Thanks, Anish. Prakash Kaswan is an associate professor of political science and the co-director of the research program on economic and social rights, Human Rights Institute, University of Connecticut. He teaches courses on environmental and climate justice, global environmental politics, environmental policy and institutions, and research methods. He's also the author of the widely reviewed and acclaimed book, Democracy in the Woods, Environmental Conservation and Social Justice in India and Mexico. He's also the co-editor of the journal Environmental Politics. His scholarship has been published in top-ranking journals in the fields of environmental politics, policy, and international development. Anish, over to you.
Yes, Kanchi Kohli, besides being a friend, is a senior researcher at Center for Policy Research and works on environment, forest, and biodiversity governance in India. Her work explores the links between law, industrialization, and environment justice. Her research interests also include the implementation of biodiversity regulations in India. She has co-edited the books Business Interests and the Environmental Crisis and The Case for the Commons, which is a six-part e-publication on the administrative follow-up of the 2011 Supreme Court of India judgment on the protection of the commons. Since 2004, she coordinates an information dissemination service on forest and wildlife cases in the Supreme Court of India. So let's start now. I think we are looking forward to some great discussions today.
So to get us started, Prakash and Kanchi, I want to begin with a very fundamental question. How would you break down the term forest governance for the audience? Why is this even important? And what happens when forest governance goes wrong? Yeah, so maybe Kanchi first and then Prakash.
So very simply, if you want to understand forest governance is basically everything you can or cannot do in areas defined as forests. So where you can collect forest produce from, whether you can mine, whether you can lay a railway line, where there are plantations, etc. It also includes everyone who can or cannot decide on what to do in that space. So there could be constitutional limits, there could be legal limits. How is responsibility divided? All of that really constitutes forest governance. And forest governance actually also includes structures, superstructures, institutions through which all of this is actually controlled. Now, why is it important? It's extremely important because for each of these issues or each of these situations that I was talking about, everything, everyone, and all the institutions, they determine the political economy of how forests are managed and used and managed in the country. It determines hierarchies. It determines exclusion and inclusion. It also determines how forests get defined and undefined. So there's a whole bunch of things that happen. And all that is important because these are very important political questions. They don't happen in isolation. Forest governance becomes important to understand. If you don't understand history, and you don't recognize the future threats, forest governance is bound to be a failure. Forest governance policies will be failure by design.
Prakash, from your vantage point, how do you think about forest governance? Why is it important? What goes wrong when it's missing?
Thank you for that wonderful question. And let me say it's a real pleasure to be a part of this panel with all of you. and especially with Kanchi, who's been such a resource and an inspiration in many ways for many of us. So really privileged. So I just wanted to do a little bit of a governance 101. And this is from a chapter for a book called Governing Renewable Natural Resources Theories and Frameworks, edited by Fiona Noonan and published by Rutledge. So World Bank has worldwide governance indicators, and they go as follows. Voice and accountability, political stability and absence of violence, governance effectiveness, regulatory quality, the rule of law, control of corruption. Right. So this is a massive wish list. Now, if we want to think back to what Kanchi said, there's not like an easy match. Right. And the problem with this kind of World Bank wish list of governance indicators is that let's think about rule of law. Now, how do you get to rule of law? You require good governance to get rule of law, right? How do you get good regulatory quality? You require good governance to get regulatory quality. So the problem is that many of these mainstream indicators and definitions are circular. That's like you get good governance by establishing things that themselves require good governance. So they're actually, from a pragmatic perspective, they're not of much use, actually. The other important thing to think about is that there's a distinction between governance and management. People often confuse management with governance. And the main distinction between governance and management is that management is the process of achieving a set of goals that are given to the managers. Governance, on the other hand, involves deciding about those objectives. Governance is determined by the goals that those who are involved in the governance, they think and prioritize about. So management is more reductive, it's more limited, and it responds to the objectives and goals that have been set by somebody higher up in the chain.
I think the contrast between how Kanchi sort of very simply, and I think very comprehensively defined it, the what can be, cannot be done, the who cannot do something, and the structures that govern these what's and who's, versus, let's say, a very convoluted way of thinking about governance. And I suppose the question, the point you're making, Prakash, is that sometimes the lenses that we use to think about forest governance might actually impede a lot of progress, because the vocabulary then percolates downstream and leads to many confusing actions or the lack of action. So that was super, super useful. Yeah.
Thanks, both of you. So my next question is to Kanchi, and we've already spoken about what governance means, what it doesn't mean, who controls what. So let's think about India now and think that when we talk of forest governance, is the governance in forest the same in different forest types? So different forest types, will the governance structure change? Or if it doesn't, then should it change? And also, when we talk of the top-down approach in governance, is there enough effort that is being put in to look at the complexity that exists on the ground? Normally, it's easier to run countries using a broad brush. But in doing that, you tend to shortchange many different communities, especially the minorities. So how do we look at India per se? And what is your take on this?
Yeah, I mean, forest is, I think, one of the most complex spaces for a country like India. I think globally that's the case in many parts of the world. But in India, you have to actually go back to pre-colonial roots, actually try and understand what historical blunders or mishaps happened at the time of the post-colonial legalities that took place, and how systematically policy has actually ignored addressing some of those problems. So what we see today as forests, land that actually looks like forest, but actually is not recorded as forest, all of it is the complexity of forest governance that we need to recognize. And only through that, we can even try and talk about how do we approach forests. So I think what first thing we need to recognize is that forest is in most people's minds, forest is, at least from the governance point of view, for most people, it becomes a legal and administrative category. But people living in these areas or people interested in researching in these areas don't always think of it as a legal and governance category. Legal and governance category is important for administration. It's important for all the paperwork that you need to do, determine ownership, determine use, etc., all those kinds of things. But to respond to what you were saying, if you see it from the point of view of people who have social relation to these areas, I'm not sure if they necessarily think of it as forest. It's actually water bodies. It's something else. You're seeing it as home. You're seeing it as areas that you would want to use, you won't want to use. So in many ways, it's social use and relations that determine your approach to forest. Or for us, there would be certain ecological limits of what you can and cannot find in a place. Some forests will be dry, some other place, some species you'll find in areas, some areas, some species you won't find in other areas. But in governance, it's almost like you're universalizing the definition of forest. In fact, in coastal areas, for most people can't even imagine that coastal areas actually are forests. I mean, how is mangroves actually forest? How are mudflats that don't have trees on it really forest? So I think one of the first thing that we need to do when we're talking about approaching different forest areas, and particularly for governance, is actually to even recognize these differences. While legally everything might get recorded as forest land, or legally you might say dictionary meaning of forest might apply, these areas feel, look, behave very differently. The people in these areas feel, look, behave very differently. So you cannot have the same approach to any of these places. So that's the challenge of law and governance, right? Because law and governance really have very linear sort of processes. They don't take into account social uses or ecological limits. We are facing currently such huge challenges in urban forests. Today, when urban areas are wanting to capitalize on those areas, all these issues come up because forest is... Sometimes you actually decide this area is forest because it's convenient for you. Then you decide actually this area is not forest because it's convenient for you. So it's really, you know, the legal limits actually shift because of what you want to do. So when we're talking about how do we approach forests in governance, I think going back to why people are reacting to, say, certain institutions in a certain way. I mean, there's a huge debate, a huge discussion. If you talk, go to places, even if the forest department official is highly, very genuine, wanting to work with people. Prakash, you spoke about a different sort of a tussle between people and the forest department where they're going to be thrown away. If genuinely a forest department wants to work with people, because of the historical baggage of these places, it's absolutely not possible. And it's very genuine. There's mistrust, all of that. So to come back to the question, actually, different approaches are critical. I mean, without that, actually, the very diversity that we need to regard to forest as a living entity rather than just a legal category. So our approach, is determined by whether we are actually seeing it as a standardized legal category or you're seeing forest as a lived space, as an ecological space. So I think if you are able to do that, recognize that upfront, then your approach automatically changes.
Don't you think that the way we are looking at governance is in a very, it's like a commodity, like forest becomes a place where we need to do something. At that point, suddenly we realize that the rights have not been settled or there is a relationship that's going on at this point in time, which is not conducive to the activity that one wants to do on that land. So it's more from the demand driven thing where there is a demand for land and then we go and grapple with what relationships there are. And therefore, we come up with a solution, which is a stopgap short term rather than looking at it from the long term arena. I think if we can maybe change that approach in a certain way, we may be able to, I mean, there will always be shortcomings and shortfalls, but I thought, currently, the way the system is evolving, it is more to do with what we want to do there and then start going backwards and then putting all the blocks in place.
See, forests were always a commodity. I think historically, especially in India, I think our legislation tells you that, you know, it's the revenue-centered nature of the Indian Forest Act is that. It's a forest was always a commodity. And so it's always seen as a resource. But today, the commodification of forests has actually reached a different proportion in the sense we're only looking at forests from an extractive lens. So it's extractive when it comes to whatever plantations. It's extractive when it comes to recreation. It's extractive when it comes to mining. It's extractive when it comes to infrastructure development. So the commodification of forests is actually a really old fact. But the extent of commodification of forests as we see today, for definitely from the governance point of view, is all encompassing, actually. Both forests, the use of forests, as well as solutions to offset that use are commodified.
And I can actually just follow up on that and then come back to the original question, if that is okay. So this notion of commodification actually draws our attention to the fact that forests are productive, regenerative resources that can be put to good use for the society, right? So in that sense, some types of use of forests that can be good, including for forest and people, versus other types of use that are not really good for the forest. And I want to highlight here that in the forest ecology literature, if we look at the most recent research, we know that certain kinds of forest use, including limited introduction of fires by local communities, has been good for the forest. I mean, that's how we got the landscapes like Kanha National Park, for example. It's the savanna kind of landscape that we see here is partly a product of introduction of fire by Adivasis in that area. So some type of human interventions, including collection of some types of non-timber forests produced for self-consumption and so forth, can really also be good for the wildlife and biodiversity. So not all forest uses are bad in the same way. The second point that is sort of related to this is that when we, and this goes back to your framing of the question, Anish, is that, as Kanchi pointed out, I mean, in today's time, and I'm sorry to put it like that, but anything that you can imagine has been flouted in our immediate memory, purely based on the rule of convenience. I want to do something for some powerful actor, it's okay to flout a rule. And so that means that it's not necessarily a trade-off between broader national interest or broader societal interest versus the biodiversity and wildlife conservation goals. It's the interest of a very small minority of the business community, of the corporate actors who have these industrial projects or other kinds of infrastructure projects where the forest and wildlife is being sacrificed most importantly. So I think to remember that it's a problem that is related to concentration of political and economic power. It's not a struggle between poor people, the government wanting to address poverty and the interest of the biodiversity and wildlife conservation. That could be another conversation, right? But what we see right now is essentially a struggle between large-scale development projects and the interest of biodiversity and wildlife conservation, including the interest of rural communities that are linked to outcomes of biodiversity conversation, for example.
Actually, if I can come in there, it segues very nicely into the next question on this gap between forest governance and realized behaviors, right? So if you look at different domains, could be forest, could be water, could be something as different as, let's say, financial inclusion, right? All of these different domains vary significantly on the gap between the intended, let's say, or whatever, or the theoretical policy or the governance blueprint, what at least on paper is the intention, and the behavior that actually gets realized by different actors, by institutional actors, by individuals, right? And that gap happens for roughly two reasons. One, incentives. So a bunch of actors might have incentives which run very contrary to what the formal sort of governance might say or might want. And second is ability, right? So many systems actually don't have the ability, could be a lack of financial resources, could be a lack of technology or human resources. So essentially, if you look at India as an example, what are the big sort of gaps that you see between governance on paper and the actual behavior that's realized, both of individual and institutional actors, and in harmful ways? So what are the top two or three such fault lines that you see?
Yeah. So part of this behavioral, and I want to switch gears a little bit to focus now more specifically on corporate actors, because they're really important stakeholders. Oftentimes, in many other areas of governance, there are situations where corporate actors would demand that particular kind of rules be set up and followed, because an existence of clearly defined rules, norms, and conventions, i.e. institutions, is actually central to business planning. Because if you have predictable set of governance systems, you can plan your business accordingly, right? But if you have very unpredictable governance systems, then, you know, your business plan, it's not clear what your business plan should be responding to. So it's always in the interest of the corporate sector to actually have clearly defined rules. But we don't see these kinds of demands very much in India, to the extent I know, because there is another style of governance that exists in India, which is that they cling here, we'll sort it out, right? So we deal with this in an ad hoc manner. So they say, anyway, there's not much that is predictable, so we'll have to manage it as such. And so I'm saying there's a sort of vicious cycle between the lack of enforcement of rule of law and how the business responds. So this is to be fair to them in a technical sense. But if we think about this in an ethical sense, I would say corporate actors, at least now that we are seeing the biodiversity crisis, now that we are seeing the climate crisis, and it does impinge on business interests, because if you have massive climate disruptions, no business can be safe. So now I think it is the onus is also on the business sectors to actually question that approach of dealing ad hoc with the challenges of governance and come out more strongly to demand systematic, predictable, and fair and equitable rules of governance more broadly.
I think I agree with what you're saying, Prakash. And I think I just want to say that over a period of time, I think how we approach forests as a space is extremely instrumental in nature. So it's no longer correlation. It's not a mutual respect sort of space. Basically, I will not really necessarily over-extract or accept because I need to think of it long-term, etc. It is primarily looking at productive use of forests. So whether it is keeping forests intact makes productive and revenue sense, you would go with that. Or it destroying it gets you more revenue, then you would go with that. And finally, I think what we need to recognize is social hierarchy. The thing is, you might actually have very good democratic processes laid out in your policies and laws. However, these are not naive spaces. I mean, communities are not a monolith in many ways. You know, there are serious social hierarchies in these places. Differences between tribal and non-tribal, upper caste, lower caste, urban, rural. So a huge set of those social hierarchies come in the way of how forest governance actually takes place. And finally, I think what I want to say is that most people who are writing and administering forest policies in the hierarchy of things actually are also not from these spaces. So forest governance is actually governed by people largely who are not from forests, who don't recognize forests beyond its legal definition.
That's super, super, super interesting. Thank you, Najit.
Very well put, Kanchi. So I have so many questions that are coming to my mind when I'm listening to you guys. So there are clear-cut blocks of in the way humans are going about this piece of forest governance. Some of those are learned behavior. Some of those are very much intrinsic to the species that we are. So something like tragedy of commons, which is all pervasive, which means whether you are looking at the top corporates who are competing for the same pie, or you're looking at bureaucrats in a government machinery trying to compete for the same funds, or you look at rural communities where there is competition over natural resources. There are some areas which have boundaries, some areas don't have, especially the ecosystem services that we all keep talking about. They are felt, a lot of them, and they are common property. So when we talk of this structure that we live as humans, looking at from that angle, do you think that we'll ever be able to find or to circumvent these roadblocks so that we can come up with solutions that, you know, are at scale, which start having a positive impact on the ecosystems and therefore realized by the people who are utilizing those different aspects of the ecosystems?
Yeah, I can take a stab at that. There's a long tradition of research and scholarship on this. The whole global climate crisis is actually an example of a tragedy of the commons writ large. But we have to remember that climate crisis is a product of certain types of countries and certain types of actors not letting climate governance happen and trying to create discourses of climate denialism. So tragedy of the commons is often a product of particular types of interest overriding other types of interest. And I'll give you two very simple examples. both sort of macro example and a micro example. The macro example comes from the Mexican situation. And when post-revolution, President Cardenas, who's a sort of a populist leader, and he wanted to give these forest rights, powers, and authority to ejidos and comunidades, the collectives that I mentioned, there were foresters who were saying that poor people are like ants and termites, and they're going to eat away all the forests like hungry termites. And Mexico today has incredible amount of rich rainforest on lands that are owned and managed by communities. I mean, in that situation, communities actually prepare their own management plans. They have to get it approved by the forestry agency, but they prepare their own management plan and they do timber harvesting, they do sustainable timber harvesting, and all of that happens because that's in a particular context where those kinds of actions have been promoted and have been incentivized, right? So if you own a forest from which you can harvest timber, you care about the forest, right? So there's a self-interest argument here, which is different from some of these sort of rhetorical arguments that we hear about communities will care for forest because absolutely they are in love with forest and they live in nature, in harmony with nature and so forth. I mean, that is also true at some cultural level. But at the end of the day, you need material incentives for anyone to care about forest and nature conservation. So where those incentives have been put in place, forest management plans have worked successfully. And it is also important to flag that in those places, powerful actors have also been disciplined by an existing governance system which holds the powerful actors accountable. So there's incentives for powerless actors to do the right things, but there is also incentives for or disincentives for powerful actors so that they don't come in and mess up the situation.
Yeah, I'll just quickly just speak about this thing about the challenge of the scaling solutions that you were talking about. To start with, I think one of the first challenges is that the solutions themselves are contested. I mean, there's a lot of literature on whether carbon offset schemes are actually just, or for that matter, is it a good solution to make somebody a tourist guide in lieu of relocation from a protected area? I mean, all those kinds of things are actually solutions for forest governance, related to forest governance themselves are contested. And in situations when there is a concurrence on it, then all the other factors really come into play when it comes to administering the solution. So which is where the social hierarchies, the ecological illiteracy, all those factors really come into play also when you're trying to administer the solution. But I think all I wanted to say is to end with this is that I think it's high time we adopt a justice lens to solutions. Just if we adopt a justice lens to solutions, both locally when we talk about environment justice or local justice within country or the kind of solution that you've designed, or as people were talking about globally when it comes to climate justice, that these debates are all there. The justice lens to solutions becomes very crucial because that through that you can at least minimize and avoid solutions that appear to be solutions, but in effect are false. In effect, it gives you a semblance that you can actually use up 2,000 hectares of forest for a road project and actually use double the amount of forest land somewhere else to create plantations. In the process, actually, there's injustice in both places, you know. So it's important to actually bring that. So solutions is actually a whole topic unto itself.
I completely agree with you. I think it is a very difficult topic to address. In fact, people can spend a lifetime and not yet are able to scratch the surface because of the heterogeneity in the way our interactions are based on which community you're talking, under what circumstances they are living in, and also what is the legacy that has carved them into what they are today. So it's damn difficult. Just while I speak, I thought, can we, in the world that we are in, which is measuring success through growth, which is measuring success through GDP, which is itself a contentious term, can we, to make it more inclusive, just to state an example, so a dam has come up and there are 5 villages from the valley that were picked and thrown somewhere. Okay, now the water from the dam is going and supporting businesses. Is it possible to come up with a model which is a win-win for the business people as well? Because the corporate has to benefit from it. Otherwise, urban and this the machinery of economics currently in the world, corporate players have to see some profit in it. So is it possible to create a system where profit sharing can happen in such a way that even that we take care of the legacy as well? So people who have been displaced should actually be benefited now, even if they are 50 kilometers away from the site. So I was thinking from a practical way, if that system can come into businesses which are extractive, will there be a solution in it? Will we be able to at least undo some of the damages that were happened culturally or spiritually or whatever way I'm talking? Again, money is there, but we all agree that money drives a lot of these things and the politics of it. Politics comes where money is.
I love your idealism. I mean, that we can actually find a solution for this. I think if you go back to looking at several of the solutions that have come for this, I mean, you have an entire framework of the Biological Diversity Act that governs exactly what you're talking about. When you're talking about using something like a biodiversity or a particular species for commercialization, you actually enter into a benefit sharing arrangement. Or for that matter, you have a lot of mechanisms of pricing forests, which against diversion, etc. Now, these are responses that have actually come out of exactly the kind of questions that you're asking. So they might have started off as when you're actually extracting from a forest area, you need to enter into a contract. Or when you're displacing somebody, you need to ensure that there is employment. So these principles have been in place for a very long time. And I think those principles are good principles. Nobody is going to actually deny those principles. If these principles are applied to a democratic deliberative process where the outcome is actually not predetermined, you might actually come up with some solutions like that. But the issue is the political economy that operates in this space. You see it from that sense. Even if you have a process in place, how that process gets sabotaged, how that process actually gets misutilized, how that process itself is resisted. So under the Biological Diversity Act, you actually have huge resistance to enter into benefit sharing arrangements, even when you can determine ownership. One of the biggest questions is, with something like this, is determining ownership. Who owns that particular species or a particular herb that can be harvested and turned into medicine? Who do you actually enter into the contract with in situations like that? That's why benefit sharing arrangements have been extremely difficult. Even in Africa, they've been extremely difficult. It takes a really long time. You need to get seat on the table for people, ensure there is the atmosphere, the environment to actually have discussions is conducive. The language that in which you are actually negotiating is at par. So principally, nobody will say that this should not be done. I mean, good corporate practice should imbibe these principles. But I think what we've seen over a period of time is a huge resistance to entering into these, you know, things. In fact, right now, currently in India, you have large amount of litigation that is even questioning that we need to pay basic fee for using biodiversity from forests. So I'll just say that we can put good principles in place. But when the rubber hits the ground, I think you see all that we've been speaking about, the hierarchies, money, political economy in different ways operate to resist a democratic, socially just outcome of a process.
Yeah, I think that's so very well put. And again, going along with the sort of the behavioral thread that we have had throughout the discussions, I always like to say, okay, let's try and see what is the minimum expectation we can set for some of the powerful actors. So if we think about the joint forest management, right? In joint forest management, you're basically giving very little like peanuts to the communities. And now if you happen to be the forest department, you're getting these poor communities to do your job essentially, because forest protection is your job, in return for what is basically nothing, right? Now, if I were the forest department, would not I actually latch onto that model and spread that model throughout the country and work on it? So the point is that I think oftentimes when we talk about these, you know, larger goals of justice and sustainability, it's always actually helpful to start with the bare minimum and see that the basic minimum conditions that could have created something like this, who has made use of those models or not. And so that's one part of it. The second part of it, if you can think about we talked about carbon offsets. There's an ideological sort of discussion about pro and anti-carbon offsets on both sides of ideological divide. And I think there is something about the argument that when you put a resource like forest into a market kind of system, the market has its own way of functioning. And so it actually undermines both the goals of environmental conservation and social justice. But let's, for a moment, let's put that argument aside. Let's say we give in to this kind of neoliberal model, and let's say we accept forest offset model. Now let's look at how many communities have gotten actual resources out of the forest carbon offsets. In India, I don't know of any community which is given any benefit out of forest offset projects. So again, I think going back to, and this is what we mean, for example, when Kanchi mentioned that we have to look at political economy. Why is it that some communities in Latin America has gotten actual benefits of forest offset projects and none have got those kinds of benefits, mostly in Asia and Africa? There's a particular kind of regional political economy that operates in these different regions. And those models of forest governance actually respond to, you can see in real time with empirical data, that models of forest governance do respond to political economy. So we have to intervene at that level. It's not easy, of course. You're talking about the most powerful actors with most powerful incentives and disincentives that have been set in place for a long time. But it does come down to the question of political economy in that sense.
So, Kanchi, this is linked to what you said, right? So there's a huge sort of difference between stuff that is ideal, let's say questions of restorative justice, etc. And they might even be happening in some parts of the world. But maybe when the rubber hits the road, we're not really getting anything done. But yet at the same time, it's super crucial that actually stuff moves very quickly, keeping in mind 2030, keeping in mind 2050. Are you seeing some bright spots, right? In this otherwise doom and gloom, are you seeing some things in forest governance that seem to be working in India, even outside of India? Is there stuff that gives you some comfort? And is there something that we can learn from that and deploy at scale within India when it comes to forest governance?
I think one of the biggest things that gives anybody hope or any one of us hope is the fact that most people cannot deny that there is a problem, there's a crisis. Climate change, for most people, I mean, there will be deniers all the time. Now, what the challenge is, of course, what you do with it. The other thing I think which is very crucial is the energy of both rural and urban youth, which is very much backing forest conservation, that is pushing governments, that is pushing policymakers to say, create intergenerational sort of solutions to forests. They are pushing the idea of justice here. So I think those are very crucial things. And I think the third thing is, I think our local solutions are still very resilient. You have forest dwelling communities who can still demonstrate highly sustainable and socially just solutions that we have to present alternatives. I mean, these are debatable processes, but at least there is a recognition that it needs to be done in a certain way. And I think if we can bring back those conversations, bring back the polarized kind of positions onto the table, we might be able to, and I think we are ready for that. And I think we are ready for that because no matter which side of the fence you are, I think there is a recognition that there is a large amount of pressure on forests today, on ecosystems today, and we cannot avoid working up a solution. And that's why I suppose we are talking today here. So that's, if there is any hope, it's that. Everything else is actually highly gloomy.
Thank you, Anshi. Prakash, from your vantage point, the different countries you've studied, what sort of are some of the good things you've seen that give you hope?
So continuing with the political economy theme, I think in a situation of serious power imbalances, where there are historically entrenched inequalities that even prevent us from getting to the table in an effective way and deliberating on democratic, inclusive, sustainable, efficient solutions, one has to see some kind of a change at the top, in the sense that, is there a change in the environment for the most powerful actors? And I think on that, in addition to what Kanchi said, I think even on that ground, we see some movement. Recently, there have been a number of global sort of debates where the questions of justice and how the lack of accountability of the most powerful actors actually prevents us from coming up with good governance systems. Has this, these kinds of arguments have now been accepted even at the highest level? The global biodiversity community is increasingly very receptive, at least, to have discussions about how the legacies of colonialism, racism, casteism, and gender inequalities, and how these kinds of questions actually shape outcomes of biodiversity conservation and wildlife conservation. And fortunately, I think we are moving in the right direction in terms of questioning the models, the underlying assumptions, the philosophies of conservation that have got us here. And that I see as a sign of hope.
I think it's important for us because, see, we have been practitioners. So it's like this movie, Sherni. No? When that movie came, people at the end of the movie, they said, movie is well made, but we didn't understand what is the director trying to say. Because there were a lot of issues. So how does a podcast like this eventually, when we end it, where the audience goes out thinking that, yeah, this is like a big tsunami of issues, but at least I could take these four or five things out of it. And so my question now is, if you were to wear a hat of a policymaker or a local community or a corporate or a wild species that's living in the forest, what will be your message to the listener?
If you look at the climate crisis, if you look at the social crisis, and both of them will feed into one another. They're already feeding into one another. So what happened in Uttaranchal, for example, because of the cloudburst and the tragedy of human deaths that followed it, 20 years down the line, you would have a situation of lawlessness if you don't address some of those fundamental questions of respecting human dignity, respecting the integrity of nature, and respecting the rule of law. So I would, for all of the actors combined together, if we get these three things right, human dignity, integrity of the natural and ecological systems, and the rule of law, that is the bare minimum we need to do to stay afloat as a society.
So as a policymaker, deliberate, democratize, and decentralize decision-making. That's what I will, without really preconceived outcomes, I will talk about that. As a local community, top-down solutions don't work. Do not move without my consent. As a corporate, I will not break the law to get a forest diversion or a biodiversity access approval. And as a wild species, if I can't speak, if I can't be heard, does not mean I'm not there.
Fantastic. The sum up of whatever you guys have done is important because people have to at least understand that some things are difficult and therefore solutions are difficult to come by, but that doesn't mean you stop trying.
I just want to say thank you both Tachi and Prakash, and I truly enjoyed the conversation. So thank you again. I think literally decades of work and your perspectives have gone into this, and so thanks again.
Thank you for listening to Talking About Forests. We hope the conversation sparked some ideas. To learn more about the guests and our work, do check out the show notes, and don't forget to tune in to the other episodes.